This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm talking to Bill Corbett, which is a great pleasure for me. Bill's kind of a hero for me in publishing and writing. How are you, Bill?
I'm fine, David.
Well, you have been, you know, just sort of to set the backdrop, you're from Boston, but you... And I kind of always identified you as a figure located in Boston, and it was surprising when you left there and moved to Brooklyn. Can you maybe talk a little bit about your history, your background in Boston, and what happened that got you to move?
Beverly and I were married in 1964. And came to Boston because we felt we didn't want to live in New York. It was too close to our parents. And we'd been to Boston and were charmed by the city. We lived in and around the city until 1969, when through friends, we discovered the South End. At that point, a totally moribund district filled with magnificent brick and brownstone houses. We were able to afford one. We bought it. The luck of our generation, we had no real estate genes. So in 1969, we buy what is a five-story townhouse for a pittance. It's close enough so that I can walk across the street to walk across the city to teach at Emerson College. It's near school. It's a wonderful place to live, wonderful place to grow up, to raise our children. You cut to 44 years later, Beverly, a psychologist, retires, and because of the taxes, we would have been on the edge, hard to afford that house. Meanwhile, our daughter living in Brooklyn has a balloon mortgage, needs help with that. Both Beverly and I, more me than her, had always had a New York life. Some of our closest friends, the art world. So moving to New York to live in Brooklyn, to buy our daughter's house from her and to live near our grandchildren, both our daughters live there, was very easy to do. And it took us a year. We sold the house and made an enormous profit, totally happenstance, total luck. And on that, we're able to buy the house. We now live in, buy our daughter a condo, and begin a life in Brooklyn. So it was easy to do on one hand, but obviously you live somewhere for 44 years, there is the wrench too. But that's how it came to be.
Well, and for you, and that, by the way, that's a great story. But for you, I think the connection between Boston and New York, kind of the literary connection, has always been pretty strong. And you, in many ways, have been associated with so many New York-based writers, you know, the New York School of Poetry, essentially. So in a lot of ways, it does make sense, you know, your connection to...
That part of it was easy, obviously. And I've always, I've written about painters, a book on Philip Guston, who, while he taught at BU, Philip is one of the great New York painters of the New York School. So there was always some back and forth. Frankly, it was more difficult to leave the house we lived in, because I loved that house, and so did Beverly, than to leave Boston. After you lived in Boston for 44 years, New York is just so much fuller of life that when you walk in that door, you're simply immediately turned on. So as far as retirement from Boston went, we went to absolutely the right place for us.
No, that's great. Yeah, that's a great image, I think. What I also think in a lot of ways, when I think of the South End, the kind of look and feel, there is a correlation between it and Brooklyn, the scale and scope of the buildings, essentially.
Yeah, I could imagine that. Sure, what there is what there is so much more of New York of in New York is the obvious. Everything, the mix of the street life, the all of the art that I can now see more than I can ever see, all of the movies, and the other thing I had to leave, which was teaching. I managed to commute for 2 years and then stopped. I was teaching at MIT at that point. I've gone back into the classroom because I missed it so much, and I'm teaching at NYU Gallatin. I don't want to make it seem that the leaving Boston was without difficulty. It was. But the fact of going to New York, where, you're right, long time associations, many dear friends. I mean, old friend Paul Auster lives in Sirius that live across the park, so I see them a lot more, or I see Ron Padgett a lot more, or so all of that is to the good. But you leave your home for 44 years, and you leave behind that identity. I certainly don't have the same identity in New York.
I think that is significant. And that's maybe what we should talk about now, is the kind of your identity in Boston, both as a writer and as a kind of touchstone for other writers, connects somewhat to the work you did as a publisher. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that and give you a chance to talk about your earliest work in publishing, which I think was Fire Exit, but maybe you'll tell me differently, the magazine. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how Fire Exit began and where that fits into your work.
Fire Exit began when Molly Howe began the New Poets Theater, and she asked her daughter Fanny, who was a close friend of mine, we're both at this point in our mid-20s, whether I'd come in to help edit a magazine that would promote the New Poets Theater. I said, sure. We published one issue, which was a disaster because there was a third editor, who can remain nameless for this, who didn't take care of the technical aspects of it, and so it was a mess. This kind of magazine would not have done much for the theater. It was just an add-on, so we did that one. Then I wanted to keep it alive. Fanny wanted to keep it alive, and literally I ran into a college friend on Beacon Street, and I was telling him about it, and he said, you know, I just inherited some money, and I'm going to write you a check. And I thought, well, this will be terrific, and he'll send $100, and he didn't send $100. This is about 1967. He sent more than that, and it was enough to start to keep Fire Exit going. Fanny and I did the next issue and the ones after that, and the foldouts, which I did. Those were my babies. So I had that background. The other publishing I did was to be involved in an anti-war demonstration, an anti-war organization here called Artists Against Racism in the War, and I edited a series of broadsides called Peace Feelers. And so after hanging around at the Grolier Bookshop, meeting an enormous number of people, being a gregarious guy, wanting a literary life, there I was in the midst of it.
And there you were. Well, so talk about maybe the kind of what Fire Exit as a literary magazine was trying to do, you and Fanny together.
Well, what we were trying to do was to get to do what anybody would do, I would think, David, to get the best writers we could and to make a splash, a name for ourselves. We also wanted to publish people who had an involvement with the theater. So we did a couple of poems of Bill Alford's and I think a song from Hogan's Goat, because Bill Alford had long been involved with the old Poets Theater, and now was the new Poets Theater. You go to your friends. Jim Harrison was a friend, so Jim Harrison. Fanny went to a number of people, Gray Riven, Gray Gowrie, also a friend of mine, and we put together a magazine that, as I say, we thought would make some noise. It didn't, but that was because we were rookies and we fumbled away. We didn't do the technical aspects right, very poor design, and that's become a kind of, well, I think of that all the time, that I don't want to make the same mistakes I made then. What I learned in doing that was that, for me at least, that I wanted to always, as an editor or as a publisher, I wanted to make the magazine. I didn't want to sit around and wait for things to come in, as we say, over the transom. That had no interest for me. I knew pretty much who I wanted to publish. I also knew that I could trust other writers, that if somebody, if Harrison said, my sister-in-law, Rebecca Newth, has written some good poems, well, why wouldn't I believe Jim, and why wouldn't? So I read them, agreed with him, and published her. In 1971, DeWitt Henry and Peter O'Malley asked me to be one of the founding editors of Plowshares. I agreed and served with them for about the first 5 issues, but their vision of a magazine was so totally different from mine. They wanted to only publish stuff pretty much that came in over the transom, and they wanted revolving editors, which seemed to me, I could understand it as a kind of break-in, you know, nightclub in which you're going to be able to play to your first audience. But to look at a magazine that would have, say, 150 pages of poetry and would have 80 poets in it, was a cacophony. I couldn't read it, and I wanted to make something that was readable, and I also wanted to publish much more than poetry. I wanted to try to get reviews, and by Fire Exit 3 and 4, it moved into the territory that it became more of the magazine that I could imagine, the one I could edit.
So how many issues of Fire Exit were produced?
Well, we had 4 stand-up issues, and then we did something that it didn't work, but I still believe that I believe in this. We did 5 fold-outs. This was taking a signature and folding it up so it looked the size of a regular magazine, but when you unfolded it, you could think of it as space. And by this time, in the early 70s, I was friendly with a lot of painters. I could involve them. They could do a cover, maybe some interior drawings. And then, in a big broadside-like form in the interior, for instance, you could have 15 poets if you didn't have too many long poems, or you could go down and have 6 poets and have more of them. They'd be like constellations in this. The problem with it was that when you put it into bookstores, people would have to unfold it to see what it was. This irritated bookstores. They would get grimy. People would not buy them. I still have a few copies. We did, with Susan Howe, one with a David von Schlegel drawing. I thought it was a good idea, but it didn't work.
No, it is. Well, it kind of seems one of those, it's like an idea that artistically works conceptually, but runs into this practical difficulty, you know, in terms of how do you display it? How do you let people know what it is?
Absolutely right. But for me, if it didn't work practically, I was sitting with a whole bunch of them and was able over the years to give them away to a lot of people, and they were happy to have them. But I view it as a failure. And of course, I've understood from the start that failure was going to be part of this, not like baseball where you might, you know, get only 4-3 hits in 10 at bats, but there would be failures, and I've tried to learn from every one of those and do something a little bit differently as I went along.
Well, which is probably true of I mean, I think it's true in writing and in life in general that if you don't take chances and fail, then you really don't ever get a chance to learn anything.
Teaching can be like that too. And sometime in the mid 70s, when Lewis Warsh, who had arrived in Cambridge for a while, Lee Harwood from Brighton, England, who had become a friend when he lived in Boston, we got together with John Wieners and did the first and one of the few mimeographs in Boston called the Boston Eagle. And we went through three issues of those. And by that time, I began to figure out that my writing, the publishing, whatever, whenever I was doing it, my teaching were all part of the work. They weren't divided. I didn't put on my teacher's cap and then take it off and then put on my writer's cap. That they were all part of it, and they all fed one another, at least in my life. I don't know that this has to happen with anybody else, but given who I am, it may have been a necessity. So all of those things went together.
Yeah, no, I think that is a common thread among the people that I've, certainly people I've spoken to and a lot of people I know, and for myself as well, that I, you know, that the publishing, the editing is kind of an extension or a piece. It's a, you know, as you just said, there's no division. It's an extension of the work, or it is the work, you know, equal to the writing, and for many people, the teaching. And, you know, not everyone, many writers just write, many teachers teach, many writers teach, but, you know, there are some people for whom the editing and publishing becomes just captivating and part of how they express their vision of what art in writing should be.
And I'm one of those.
Well, besides the, I certainly knew John Wieners, but I did not know that you had done the Boston Eagle with him. But I also understand that you wrote a lot for the Boston Phoenix, a newspaper that I think many people today probably don't know about, but which was incredibly important in the city and beyond.
Well, I started during the time of Fire Exit and into the Boston Eagle and Peace Feelers, I'm teaching at Emerson College. I then went on to teach at Harvard in the late 70s, in the 80s. And at Harvard, where I was teaching expository writing, it dawned on me that I wasn't writing enough essays. I was basically reviewing an occasional book. I was, writing for small poetry publications with no editorial support. It would come in, they'd publish it. And I thought, well, you got to write some more essays. You've got to start writing about art. And I started writing about art, and Art News would take it and other art publications. But then I had a colleague named John Gorelick who became an editor at the Phoenix. And I started pitching him ideas, and he started publishing the work, which went in all sorts of directions. Not only book reviews, but many years later, when Bob Creeley died, John said, well, write Bob's obituary. The same for John Wieners. When Pressed Wafer began, he said, well, maybe you could write something about what it's like to run a small press in Boston in the beginning of the new century. So there was that. And he was always terrific as a supporter. And the Phoenix got bigger at that point. And there was one in Providence, and there was one in Portland. So I'd get, I think, a $150 check for the review from Boston, and then $20 from Providence, $20 from Portland. It became a much bigger enterprise. But John was a good editor who had what I think an editor ought to have. You get interested in a writer and you say, what do you want to do? And give the writer its head. So that was my relationship with the Phoenix, and it was great until there was no more Phoenix.
Well, you said something interesting there about the editorial process, you suggested that there's a, you know, a difference between the kind of literary publishing and the, I don't see the Phoenix as, you know, it's not mainstream media, but it the relationship between the writer and the editor, not just to have the editor say to the writer, go out and do this work, but it sounds like there was also what you called editorial support. Maybe you could talk about what that means to you.
Well, it means a lot to me because for a long time I didn't have it. And when Zolden Books published my book of essays and reviews and writings on the movies and writings on painting called All Prose, as I looked through these, I was aware of just how much I didn't have. I mean, I wasn't like somebody who had gone to work at the New Yorker in the mid-20s and encountered that extraordinary woman, Eleanor Gould, who was their great fact checker and goddess who could scare the pants off anybody. In my world, small magazines and even larger magazines, you simply didn't have editors read you in the way that when you got a good editor, you realized you needed to query you, to question you, to get a good copy edit of your work. All of those things don't always take place. And when they do, you feel the kind of foundation, the kind of floor under you that gives you confidence. And regardless of how what readers are going to think of what you've done, they can think whatever they want, but at least what they're getting is the best you could do. And there's also that a sense, David, of camaraderie that can develop from that. I've just read Robert Gottlieb's memoir, which I found terrific, his memoir of publishing. I've never worked in any kind of office remotely like that. But one of the things I liked about his description of Simon & Schuster Knopf, his years at the New Yorker, and at Knopf again, was a sense of a company. I mean, a company of people, and the word Creeley loves so much, a company of people, whether they were in promotion and sales or copy editing, book design, and so on, working together. Very rarely in my literary life did that happen. And when it did, I was grateful for it, just as I was grateful when Gail Mazur asked me to come on and do the Blacksmith Reading House, because she had done it for many years and she needed some new blood. It was nice to work through her with people who, if you called up and said, you know, we need some more change, they would do the work. And it wasn't just left up to you. So it's that kind of support I'm talking about. It's support across the board. But it begins, at least in publishing, editorially, we do this with Press Wafer, of making sure that the text, for instance, is as clean as you can possibly get it. Sounds simple, but it isn't unless it is if you do it. There's lots of ways to avoid doing it. Well, we'll get five of us to proofread this. Never works as well.
Well, and there are, I mean, I think there are two levels there, or maybe three, but the one is, and I think this is, you know, you've touched on, and that is the importance of the editing as quality control. You know, just to make sure that the work is as clean and accurate as it could be or should be. But then there's this sort of deeper relationship between editors and writers, and that's more in publishing is called developmental editing. And that's where the writer and the editor in some way are collaborating. I mean, I think the writer is always primary, but the editor has a big influence because, you know, it helps to shape, especially, I mean, less true with poetry. I think that
definitely less true with poetry. And something you probably do not know is that in the early 90s, Jay Lachlan got in touch with me and said, I've been told that you're the person to write the history of New Directions. I still haven't found out the people who told him that. I know some of them, but I don't know where. And I'd known him casually for a number of years. I went to see him. He and I agreed to do this. I accepted an advance, and I was to learn an enormous amount from him. The book turned out to be a failure because he died before it could be completed, and his executors didn't want it completed. He was always ambivalent about it, and I hadn't really figured out how ambivalent he was. But in talking to him and talking to his great co-editor, Griselda Onassian, I remember Griselda saying to me at one point, you know, Jay really isn't a great editor. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, look at all the poetry he publishes. You don't edit that. Well, of course he didn't edit that, but what he was doing as a publisher was believing in people and believing in Pound and Williams and so on, which is as great an act as, which is as great an editorial act as, you know, as the kind of thing Gottlieb would do, certainly. But no, when I've published someone's poetry, I will, if I'm asked by the writer to say, well, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? What do you think of the order? I will certainly give my opinion, but usually by the time Pressed Wafer has said, we're going to publish your book, we already believe in the poetry, and so let's go.
Right. No, I think that's, it is kind of a fraught issue, I think, with poetry, because the, you know, you think about Duncan and the, you know, the primacy of the author, you know, in the placement of every single letter, essentially. You know, it's hard to say to somebody like Duncan or Creeley or Pound, you know, people who really have clear visions. And I mean, no one's perfect. I bet that you could say, God, if, you know, if Bob had changed this line here, it would have been a better poem. But, you know, no one's going to do that. And, so that leads me to, maybe we should talk a little bit about Pressed Wafer, because okay. You've brought it up, and maybe you could talk about where, you know, when did Pressed Wafer start and what is it all about?
Well, in 1999, poets Joe Torra, he lives now in Somerville, poet and novelist. Joe had a magazine called Lift, and he and the poet Dan Bouchard, who had a small magazine called Mass Avenue, got together, and they wanted to start a new publishing thing. And they came to me and said, well, you've done this before. You want to get back into it? And I first said, no, I think I've done enough. It's your turn, and so on. But they kept after me, and we kept on talking, and suddenly I found myself in it again. By the way, a big spur to that was I met Steve Clay of Granary Books. One of the great motive forces in at least the kind of poetry that interests me most and publishing that interests me most in the last 25 years. Steve was putting together a show at the New York Public Library with Rodney Dennis, was then the librarian, and a guy who was really interested in the poetry that had been written in the last 50 years. And it was called, the show ultimately became called A Secret Location on the Lower East Side, which was the location out of which Ed Sanders published his early and probably unmentionable.
You can just fuck you a magazine of the arts.
The arts, but I can say that.
Absolutely.
Anyway, Steve was scouring the poets of my generation, particularly for mimeograph magazines. I had a ton of them. So many that Beverly would sometimes pass a closet and go, oh, what are these? Give me a break. And I sold them all to him for a tiny sum. And I figured, well, now I've got enough money to give, you know, we didn't buy a new stove, but I think a new boiler. Something came out of that for 9 Columbus Square, and we made it, and suddenly this windfall. But there was several thousand left over that I thought, let's go. Let's do it right at the start. And we began publishing two magazine issues, and then we began publishing chapbooks. the chapbooks really didn't interest me that much, but it was a way for a lot of younger poets, people Dan and Joe were interested in, to get started. And finally I said, look, and I think we have to do books. This is what's got to happen. There are people around, including you, Joe Torre. We did a number of his books, who want to have a book out. And as we moved into that, it became more and more my baby until it is my baby. And we're now into 2016, and there's a website, and there we've done over 100 and so books, postcards, oddments of all kinds. And I never expected to be back in that. I never expected to have published a couple of full-scale art books or of novels or 4 books of essays by George Schlabe. But one thing has led to another, followed my nose, which has been true, and now Pressed Wafers up and going. By the way, it runs very simply. We do not apply to grants. I don't want to support an arts bureaucracy. We would accept money if it came, somebody knocked on the door with it. We run on subscriptions and angels, and have been lucky enough to publish our books in that. We also have a great designer, Michael Russom, who came in about 7 years ago, and he makes everything work. His books just look as good as any books that you'll see in the store. And of course, that's one of the things you hope to do for a writer when you're not paying them a royalty. You want to give them the best looking book possible.
Well, of course. And what is your method of sales and distribution? Is it a combination?
Now that's the hard part. Distribution is always the bitch in this, and I've not conquered it any more than anybody else. We go through SPD. When I find a bookstore that will take the books, the Strand in New York will, but I have a hard time with McNally and Jackson. Then I'll place the book there. The community bookstore in Brooklyn will take them. It's hard to get the book into the places where people will read it. Everybody, well, you know it very well. Everybody will tell you that distribution is the difficulty. We do have SPD in California, but they're not a traditional distributor. The books do get on Amazon. Depending now on how young the writers are, the younger the writers, they're doing a lot of distribution themselves through emails or getting people to come into the website and buy the book there. We do something a little bit different, I guess, than most small presses. Since we have about 150 subscribers, books go to them, and I'll send out review copies. But then I give the writers 150 copies themselves, so that when they go and do readings, they can take the book with them, sell them. That becomes their royalty, and it becomes a way to get it distributed. When it works, everybody wins. And Pressed Wafer is not, the floor is not caving in because of the weight of the books. I've gotten better about the number of copies.
Yes, I think that if you talk to most editors, publishers who have worked in what we call literary publishing, they're probably all awash in a sea of books.
Absolutely. And then you run into the problem of what do you do with them at an advancing age? I'm going to turn 74 tomorrow. And, we'll see. I don't think I'm going to hire somebody to drop them in a dumpster, but how to get them distributed is always the question. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that in the explosion of small presses, and particularly small press poetry publishing, the person has not come forward to say, I see my future as the distributor of all of these books, and I'm going to take my meager inheritance and buy this small building and make sure your books are everywhere where they need to be. That person hasn't come along. But the books get around. You just keep at it. you fill the envelopes and send them out, and they get there.
Are you, in fact, that was a question I was going to ask you. Do you yourself pack and ship a lot of books?
I pack and ship all the books. Because Beverly is always saying, William, get an intern. And my feeling is, I really can't. If I had more work for an intern, I would get an intern. But packing and shipping books isn't enough. And I sort of like it, you know, sit down and watch a baseball game, a football game, and you do it. Plus, there's something I like. I like reminding people who give us checks that there's a person behind this. This is a cottage industry, and that seems to me to be right. It's not the glamour part, obviously, but there it is. And I get to know a lot of. I've always been interested in mail, and it's fun to even buy stamps now at a time when nobody's sending any mail. So for me, it works.
Well, I certainly concur. Do you publish the mostly poetry, or you do other things, but is there a predominance of one kind of work or another?
It started off mostly poetry, but then we've published novels. Jonathan Strong published. We're about to publish a second novel. Two art books have come our way. These are big projects. They were brought to us by angels who said, would you like to do this? We'd like to work with you. And I said, fine. I can't afford it, but you can. Let's do it. George Slaba, our bestseller, is a terrific writer of essays and reviews, a freelance intellectual, a disappearing breed. And I'd always wanted to see his work in print, could never interest another publisher in it. And when I started doing books, we did his book, What Are Intellectuals Good For?, which became our first bestseller. We sold around 4,000 copies. We've got books of essays. Since I moved to New York, things are coming to me that I would not have gotten up here, because there just aren't those kinds of writers around here. So poetry at the core, I'd say. But, well, we did a fresh riff for Bill Berkson because somebody brought it in, and Bill's a friend, and it looked to be a pretty terrific thing. I think I can tell now when a project is a small press project and is our kind of small press project. The poetry's always easy in the sense that we're always going to publish Ed Barrett. That's one of the foundational things of the press. But the other books, the essays and so on, or what I'm thinking of, we did a book by Daniel Aaron, our oldest writer, is 103 when it was published. It's a commonplace book, something that he never got around to publishing. He was keeping it up, actually, until shortly before his death. It was the perfect small press book, and it was pretty successful. So I'll look at anything at this point. And the poetry keeps coming in, and we try to fit it in where we can.
So I think for many literary publishers, they are expressions of the individuals that create them. But when you think about publishing other literary presses, are there any in particular that you look at as maybe not necessarily models for what you're doing, but as expressing what you believe is greatness in literary publishing?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of models, and they are. I follow in the wake of people. I follow in the wake, in some ways, of Jonathan Williams and Jargon. I certainly have taken, the hours I spent with Jay Laughlin. I learned a lot from, and of course, I learned a lot from New Directions. So when I look at the early New Directions, we're not so different. The very early New Directions, certainly. Barney Ross and Grove Press. I'm not going to take on 64 lawsuits, but the kind of writers he published and committed himself to that I could imagine committing myself to. In terms of magazines, one of the greats, John Ashbery, Ann Dunn, Rodrigo Moynihan, and Sonia Orwell's Art and Literature, terrific. So, yes, definitely, there are models. And this is part of a tradition that, but of course, part of that tradition, part of the small press tradition, is a certain crankiness, is a certain, does this make sense? Yeah, it makes sense to me. Doesn't really have to make sense to anybody else, you know, on that level. The books just have to come out and try to find their place in the world.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting to think about, the crankiness. But also I think about with you and many other literary magazines and presses, there's also the strong element of the social that shouldn't be neglected. And that is that, you know, that writing creates a community, or writing needs a community, and that the magazines and presses help form a community within writing, of writing. And I think, you know, that's been part of your work.
Yes. Well, here's where 9 Columbus Square, our house, comes in, having this big house. We'd always do events, press wafer events at the house, including giving John Wiener's the first annual and only, I'm sure, Pressed Wafer Man of the Year Award, because we wanted to give him some money. And 140 people came to that party and packed the second floor. What great luck to have that house. And absolutely. Community is part of it. And I don't mean community in any, we all have to room together next semester term. I mean that there's people who care for these arts, and you want to be around them, and you want to work with them. Part of the pleasure of this, and honestly, in the small press, you don't get enough of it, is to work with other people. For me to go to see Michael Russom and learn as much as I can, and I always learn something about how you put together a book and typefaces and his design principles. What a pleasure. It intensifies life and extends the world. I mean, I'm Bob Creeley and I were close friends for many years, and I always thought that Bob's touchstone of company, like-minded people. By like-minded, you're not marching in any army, or you're not sitting in a row of school seats. The New York School never did that, of course. It's those people you can have a conversation with who are involved and interested in the things that you're involved and interested in. Who wouldn't want to be a part of that? I know there are people who don't, but I'm not one of them. I'm all for it.
Well, and it seems like you have helped to foster that. You know, it's not just that you support it, but, you know, it seems to have been one of your attributes that
it is. First of all, it's great to be married to a world-class cook who's up for it, who will feed a lot of people. It's great to have a big house. And one of the things that led to what you're talking about is to stay in one town, in one city, for 44 years. Boston, which is the city that people visit. They come here to school, and then they leave. And then they come back, and they're friends, and they come over, and soon you've got a party, or, you know, Bob Creeley brings Steve Lacy into the mix, or you know Tom Raworth, and you know Tom Picard, and they come, and I was running readings at MIT for years. People could stay at the house. We'd have dinners. It was a way, of course, with all of the readings I was ever involved in, that people could make a little bit more money. They didn't have to, and they didn't have to sleep on somebody's couch. So those attributes directly reflect my good fortune at marrying Beverly, and my good fortune at having that house, and of wanting a life in literature, of wanting a literary life at the same time that I'm a writer.
Right. No, I think that's a very important thing. Is there anything that I have not asked you about that you would want to make sure to talk about in this context?
I don't think so. I guess a couple of things. Two things, really. I was fortunate to see a sign in the Grow Your Wind. Well, three. My sense of community within poetry and within literature has a lot to do with walking into the Grow Your Bookshop on one dark November afternoon in 1964 and becoming close with Gordon Kearney. I met all sorts of people there. It was a vivid life. And when he died in 1973, in some way, whatever Beverly and I did without a plan in Columbus Square was a continuation of what Gordon had going there. This was a man who actually loved poets and of all kinds. So there's that. Then I was lucky to see in the window one day a call from a publisher I'd never heard of, Roland Pease, Roland Books. He took one of my books, and it was terrific to be published by somebody who was local. You could go and visit and talk about your work. So that was a piece of luck. As far as Press Wafer is concerned, I think one of the things it taught me is that one thing does lead to another if you're open to it. And I've learned how to be open to it. I've learned how one thing does lead to another. And from Laughlin, I learned something that to me is, I would want to emphasize, trust the writers. All kinds of writers have put me on to things that I wouldn't have been put on to. I don't deal in a world of agents, obviously. Why would they be interested in publishing with somebody who doesn't give them an advance? But so you're dependent upon the writers. That's another way of getting involved or of creating this company. But companies always create themselves. There's no major domo at it. You just set a good table, you have lots of wine, and you get people to enjoy themselves, and you enjoy it too.
That's pretty good. That's great. I really appreciate your talking to me about all of this. And let me just ask one other question. When you think about, I don't know why this is important to me, but when you think about the writers and editors and publishers that have been important to you, do you, and you've talked about several of them in the course of this conversation, but is there anyone who stands out to you as someone that you would say to anyone listening, here's a writer that you probably have never heard of or read that you ought to, before you go any further?
Well, we're publishing a marvelous poet. I think the terrific poet, Ed Barrett, who is too little known. I would say get his work. I would say take a look at Granary Books website, because the range of things that Steve Clay has done and the range of collaborations that he has instigated. And this goes not just from literary stuff, but stuff in the book arts. So I would think of those two. I can't think of anybody who's so hidden, but you'd want to. I think anybody could learn from the career of a poet, novelist, editor of United Artists books like Lewis Warsh. I think yeah, all those people for sure. But you know, it's always hard. That's one of those hard questions because your mind starts to race to mention everybody, and you can't. So you always leave some out. But I'll leave it at that.
Right, and I'm sorry in a way that is kind of an unfair question. It's like the people who are, you know, at the end of the Oscars or something, having to thank everyone. It's impossible to do. So, but you know, I was just sort of looking for. And you gave an, I think you gave a really good answer to that. It's, you know, I was looking for, you know, maybe an example of someone that, and you, whom you gave, the people that might not otherwise know about.
Okay, there it is.
So, well, thank you so much for talking to me, Bill Corbett. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host, and I recommend listeners to visit the Pressed Wafer website, which I will give in the text, and enjoy some of the work that Bill Corbett's been doing.
Well, thank you. And at some point, you may want to talk about the Poets Theater, which I'll be ready for when you're ready.
That would be wonderful. That we will do that in another. I think another. I may want to set up a another conversation about Poets Theater that would involve some other people. You know, that would be a sit down maybe with you and Susan and Fanny Howe, which would be fantastic.
Sure, we could do that. Absolutely.